experience as like
yeah.
children. So when I talk just about a lot of the music.
That's great.
Services, June 9th, 2015. Eric, are we on?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 469. This is going to be a very short public hearing, and then we'll go directly to a work session as soon as we have a quorum. I'm going to call up Sarah Basler, Annie Easton, Virginia Smith, and Cheryl Brewer real quickly.
Can I come too?
Oh, I forgot. You didn't sign up. I'm sorry. We're going to ask the senator to go first.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Monis Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview, and a little bit of East Portland. And I'm very excited about Senate Bill 469, the nurse staffing law, which hasn't been updated in 10 years. It's extremely important for every Oregonian who may be a patient in a hospital, as well as for nurses and other workers who work in hospitals. You're going to hear from two major stakeholders, the Oregon Nurses Association and the Oregon Association of Hospitals also. They went through blood, sweat, and tears to have this bill come before you right now. And the bill does keep decision-making about nurse staffing exactly where it should be with the nurses. And it keeps on the process first established in 2001 of requiring nursing staffing plans, to be based on a number of factors, and they'll get into that. So as a nurse and as an Oregonian and as a state senator, I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate your insight. So the previous panel called up. Would you please come forward?
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm pleased to be here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association to provide testimony in support of Senate Bill 469 and the A-10 amendments. This legislation is the result of a several years long process that has involved many ONA members and leaders from around the state. Our nurse members have reported to us that staffing is both one of their top concerns in their practice, and that unfortunately, the trend they're seeing with staffing in a hospital setting is that it's getting worse, not better. Increasingly, national data is showing a connection between staffing and patient safety and patient outcomes. As you may know, Oregon's one of a handful of states in the country that has enacted legislation around nurse staffing. Our existing law is based on a collaborative committee approach that outlines the process rather than the specific staffing levels that must be in place. This approach is somewhat flexible and appropriately delegates decision-making around nurse staffing to nurses, both at the managerial and direct care levels. It also allows for some regional flexibility and takes into account the unique needs of each hospital and the patients that facility serves. The legislation before you today builds on that collaborative committee approach. As this bill was discussed in the Senate Healthcare Committee, ONA spent a lot of quality time with our partners at the Hospital Association, talking through our shared and differing concerns and potential solutions. And I really want to thank the Hospital Association for their commitment to that process. I'm pleased to tell you that the bill you have before you today, as well as the A-10 amendments, represents an agreement and a final product that both organizations support. The legislation is focused on improving enforcement, empowering staffing committees, and enhancing transparency and accountability about nurse staffing at both the state and the facility level. A few highlights very quickly around improved enforcement. This bill replaces an existing random audit requirement with a requirement that audits happen every 3 years tied to the licensure process. It imposes a 60-day timeline for the state to begin to investigate any complaints received under this law, and requires a resurvey of any facility that has had an approved plan of correction, meaning that there was a found violation. On the accountability and transparency front, this bill creates a nurse staffing advisory board. That's a board that's modeled after the staffing committee. It's half direct care nurses and half nurse managers from around the state that will identify trends and make recommendations to the state based on the results of audits, complaint investigations, and plan reviews. Importantly, this bill also empowers the staffing committee in each facility. It requires the plan that's approved by the staffing committee to be implemented, with a few limited exceptions to that. The makeup of the committee remains 50% direct care staff and 50% nurse managers. It adds to the 50% direct care side one position for a member of the staff of the hospital whose services are covered by the plan but who is not a registered nurse. Most commonly, that would be a certified nursing assistant. It also establishes a mandatory mediation process in the case that the staffing committee cannot come to an agreement on a staffing plan. In that situation, the health authority would be notified and would provide a mediator who would assist the committee in coming to an agreement around staffing. Taken together, ONA firmly believes that this bill will make a difference for both patients and nurses in Oregon hospitals. Stronger enforcement will lead to quicker and more thorough resolution of staffing issues when they arise. An empowered committee will ensure that decision-making truly lies within the staffing committee and not elsewhere. Improved transparency and accountability will increase knowledge and expertise about nurse staffing. We thank you so much for your consideration of this and urge your support of the bill with the A10 amendment. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Co-Chair Bates and members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Brewer. I'm a staff nurse and have been for 14 years. I am a fill-in charge nurse. I'm also the co-chair of my staffing committee. I'm on the Oregon State Collaborative, as well as the ONA Cabinet on Health Policy. And I was on the workforce that brought this bill to you today. I'd like to tell you what this means to me as a staff nurse. Roughly 3 years ago, my hospital had a consulting firm come through, and they decided to freeze positions. What that meant was that nurses were asked to take care of patients that they didn't have the appropriate training for. They were asked to, or pushed to, take patients beyond what they felt that they were able to care for. Additionally, they had mandatory overtime that was beyond what the current state law is. They missed meals and breaks. And after exhausting every opportunity that we could to try and meet with the administrators to try and come to some resolution on some of these things, we finally filed a report with the Oregon Health Authority. It took, and that was about a year and a half ago, it took the OHA about 4 months to come out to do an audit from a complaint of over 10 nurses. When the state auditor arrived, it was one person. Over 100 nurses showed up to try and speak to that one auditor. They then decided that it was too overwhelming for the one auditor, so they had a second day where we could provide testimony and send in emails. At this point in time, we were cited in numerous instances for deficiencies, and those are still outstanding. Additional complaints have been filed with the Oregon Health Authority, and the latest one, I believe, is from September of 2014, which still is outstanding and still unresolved. Enforcement is critical to ensuring safe patient care in Oregon. And this law would, Senate Bill 469, would ensure more prompt enforcement of the law, which will lead to more timely resolution of problems or violations and more quickly restore our ability to provide excellent patient care. And there's a couple more points in the law, which I'm seeing that I'm out of time, so I'm just going to move on and ask you to support 469.
Thank you. Several of us have read the bill pretty carefully, so I think we understand what you're getting to here, so I understand.
Chair Bates and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity today to speak to you about the reforms to this law. My name is Virginia Smith. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm charged at a small community hospital in the Portland metro area. I'm also the co-chair of our staffing committee at my hospital. The experience my colleagues and I have had with the staffing law and the state enforcement side of the law illustrates why I believe the changes should are important for adequate nurse staffing. Brief summary of my experience. Administration, productivity, and budgetary decisions were made outside of our staffing committee process to downsize our emergency department in 2013, October of 2013. These decisions were simply presented to the staffing committee and made final without any feedback from the committee. The resulting staffing decisions in my emergency room prompted the nurses to file a complaint with the state on December 19th, 2013. We are still waiting for the state to finalize their investigation and issue recommendations to us. This is well outside of the 60-day timeline for the state to begin investigations of complaints that's a part of the bill. We called in March of 2014, 4 months later, to follow up since no one had responded to the complaint, and we were told to wait and that they were aware of the complaint. We continued to call every 90 days, and it wasn't until January 6th of 2015 that a state surveyor finally came. But by then, many of the problems from our original complaint had changed, and it was very difficult for the surveyor and our hospital to have a productive survey. Our goal in filing the complaint with the state was not to be punitive, but to seek outside help in identifying and resolving issues with staffing in our emergency department. And the delay in the investigation and the report of the findings have made that resolution elusive. Patient safety and good patient outcomes are best assured by maintaining adequate nurse staffing. State Bill 469 will help hospitals and nurses provide this by ensuring that staffing committees are a collaborative effort between administration and direct care nurses to establish staffing plans, and that auditing hospitals every 3 years in order to ensure the plans are in fact in place and actually meeting the staffing needs of the hospital are working. Audits should be able to identify problem areas, and the staffing committee and the hospital should be able to take quick action to correct them. My committee works hard to do this as the law exists now, but having the state come in and help us make sure we're in line is also something that is valuable to me. So thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson and members of the committee. I'm Andy Easton, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And on behalf of Oregon 62 Acute Care Hospitals, we appreciate the opportunity to testify in front of you on Senate Bill 469. We have worked closely, as stated by both Ms. Baszler and by the chair of the Senate Health Care Committee, to collectively and collaboratively partner to carefully craft the bill that's in front of you. In the interest of our time, I have submitted our written testimony, but I do want to highlight two particular areas. First, it's important to underline that this legislation does not attempt to impose nurse-to-patient ratios. As Ms. Baszler described, the Senate bill with the Dash 10 amendments actually enforces and strengthens the existing hospital nurse staffing committees. Those committees are virtual structural, enables nurse leaders and direct care staff to work together collaboratively to generate nurse staffing plans that appropriately address the needs of the patients, as well as taking into consideration the skill and the experience of the nurse. Second, the bill provides a greater predictability to nurse staffing audits, as well as timelines for investigation of nurse staffing complaints. These changes will support timely and appropriate actions to correct deficiencies. In summary, we do support Senate Bill 469 with the Dash 10 amendments. It is a significant improvement from the previous version of the legislation, and we are proud to collectively work together with our nurse partners to strengthen the current nurse staffing law.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? I have just one question. First, thank you for the work you've done. It's obviously been a huge effort in my previous life and my present life still, the other life. This is always a thorny problem for hospitals, and I'm glad you have a system set up to handle it at the hospital level where you can do the best job of really discovering what the needs are for nurses and patients. I don't like ratios. They don't work, okay? It looks good on paper. It doesn't work in reality. The only question I really have is on the complaint system. It appears from my reading of it and what Elsie has told us, anybody can make a complaint to the Oregon Health Authority about hospital staffing. But I would prefer that went to the staffing committee first before it went to OHA. If we find that OHA is swamped with constant complaints directly from them without going through staffing committee, then I think we may want to come back and revisit just that one little piece. We certainly are not going to change the bill today or stop it from moving forward. But that's just a little complaint concern I was worried about. Any questions? Any answers on that one?
Senator Bates, in many facilities throughout the state, and certainly in all the facilities where ONA represents the nurses, we've worked out a process. It's called the Staffing Request Documentation Form, and that's a form that a nurse can fill out when they have a concern about staffing. And that goes through, one copy comes to ONA, one copy goes to that nurse's manager, and that's really an attempt to resolve an issue at the facility level before a complaint is filed. And certainly in working with nurses, our goal has always been and will remain to resolve things internally prior to filing a state complaint.
We may need to get that in statute later if this kind of blows up on us, okay? Because that staffing committee is supposed to do that. And I wish that had been in the bill, but we'll leave it where it is now and see what happens. You may get so few complaints, it doesn't matter. And that would be the best outcome.
Thank you.
I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 469. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 469.
Okay. Chair Bates, members of the committee, you should have the fiscal impact, and it's also on OLIS. And there's a dash 10 amendment to the bill, and the dash 10 amendment is basically the dash 8, if you're familiar with the dash 8, with the appropriation language. And the dash 10, this is what it does. It removes the language requiring that the staffing plan be based on an accurate description of individual and aggregate patient needs and requirements for nursing care. It specifies that the definition of nursing staff includes registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, certified nursing assistants, and other hospital nursing staff as defined by Oregon Health Authority by rule. It also modifies the OHA investigation procedures, and it appropriates $552,592 general fund to the Oregon Health Authority to perform the audits every 3 years, as well as complaint investigations.
Would you like a motion, Mr. Chair?
I would love one.
I move the dash A10 amendment into Senate Bill 469.
It has been moved that we accept the dash 10 amendments to Senate Bill 469. Are there any discussion? Any questions? Any opposition? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 469 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Is it moved that we move Senate Bill 469 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended? Any discussion? Questions? Seeing none? So moved. We'll need carriers.
I'll take it to the
And the full Ways and Means, Senator Winters will carry it. I think on the floor, Senator Mons Anderson may well want to carry that. Oh, I had to say, I had not. There, okay. And the House?
Excuse me.
Sorry.
Put my name down, but that's just temporary until I check. In the next hour, I'll give you an update on that.
All right. So I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 469. Thank you all for your attention and help. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 606 relating to dental pilot project. Senator Mons Anderson, would you like to join us? Or would you not like to join us?
Which bill did you say?
606.
Okay, 606. I got it. Okay. Back in 2000. I'm State Senator Lori Monis Anderson from District 25, and 606 is an extremely important bill because it actually appropriates money to the Oregon Health Authority for extending dental pilot projects. And as you all recall, in 2011, we really started looking at dental care. And since then, it's been Representative Kenny Geyer and myself that have sort of kept the torch going to make sure that we expand innovation anyway with our DCOs and in providing dental care. So basically 606, all it does is extend the sunset so that these pilot projects can still go. We had had a sunset before, and we'd like to restore the language to operate pilot projects. Thank you.
Thank you. Kelly Barnes? Kelly, I'm going to warn you, we're holding everybody 3 minutes, and if you hear a strange chicken go off at 3 minutes, it means you're in trouble. And just so everyone knows what that sounds like, when you hear this, your time's up.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Kelly Barnes. Thank you, Chair, Senator Bates, and Nathanison for hearing our testimony. So I am here as a concerned citizen advocating for improved oral health in our community. I was helping to draft a few legislative concepts this session around dental care, and this is one of them. As Senator Montes-Anderson clearly explained already, this is simply an extension of a bill that was already passed in 2011. I would like to point out, however, there was a limitation on establishing the pilot studies due to a lack of fiscal investment initially. And it took them about 3 to 4 years to be able to administer the studies due to a lack of administrative staff through OHA. So this bill is asking for basically a 1.5 FTE to allow the administration for the data and the pilot study to continue. They are in the process right now of accepting applications, and they've been working many years to get collaboration for this pilot study. This is basically a pilot study for workforce expansion for the dental profession, because there's very much a need for expansion of workforce due to a shortage in the dental profession. So that's really all this is about, and if you have any specific questions, I welcome them.
Questions? Could you explain in simple terms how this differs from 692?
For 692,
was
that the elimination of the sunset altogether?
No, 692 is the next one on reimbursement.
So reimbursement. The next bill up. If you don't know, it's okay.
Yeah, I'm not shepherding
that's
that
fine.
Bill.
I just thought you might be able to help us with that. Okay, we'll do that next. So we have no other testimony, questions or comments.
Question.
Yes.
Your testimony really emphasizes this is about workforce. Is this about workforce or is this about improving oral health? Or
well,
is it really just both?
It's both. I mean, if you look at the statistics in the state around the dental profession, around workforce, there's a shortage of providers and there's an aging profession. And essentially, the care of dentistry may in the future be different than how we see it now, you know, particularly just in an isolated dental clinic. So there's another bill that I was advocating for this session after participating on a City Club study for oral health. I was a member of that study. And that bill is also looking at access to dental care. That was House Bill 2024. And essentially, we're looking for more creative ways in which to improve access to dental care, especially for our most vulnerable citizens. This is a pilot study, but what the pilot study allows is the actual investigation of the data for having alternatives to perhaps traditional means that might improve access to dental care. The study they're looking at now is teledentistry, which allows just a different way of approaching dentistry on the front end, and then to refer perhaps to dental providers later as needed. So it's both, essentially.
I think it's extremely, this is Lori Montes-Anderson, extremely important to know that we need to have innovative pilot projects so that we can focus on problems, high disease rates. We need to make sure that oral disease is one of the few reasons, or almost half of, at least in my district, the hospitals, half of the admissions are due to oral disease. It's one of the leading causes of absenteeism from schools. And so when our DCOs can come forward with innovative ways of addressing these needs in the community, that's what these dental projects hopefully will accomplish.
May I make one more comment about that, if it's okay? You may also recall, at least in Portland a few years ago, there was a large debate around certain dental policies, one of which included water fluoridation. This bill and House Bill 2024 is a collaboration of parties that have diverse perspectives about that particular issue. So the focus is more on workforce innovation and expansion of dental access, so it allows everybody to come to the table and participate willingly.
Do you want to ask a question, Representative Kennegar?
I was just going to answer Representative Nathanson's question if they didn't, but I think that they probably did.
I'm still having a little difficulty differentiating these two bills, but that's I'll work on some more with you. So the job of the 1.5 FTE, is that looking for grants primarily, grant money for running programs?
Essentially, it's looking for staff for OHA to administer the pilot study. What they found in 2011, initially, the prior Senate bill wasn't funded. And due to the lack of administrative staff, even to accept proposals and to look at ideas and collaborate around the pilot study, it really didn't get off the ground. So there was a one-time funding through general funding in 2014, I believe it was 14, that allowed OHA then to have the administrative staff to initiate the pilot study on the admin side. They need to be able to collect data and then report back to the legislator sessions. And that's what that is for.
In 2011, there was no funding to administer the dental projects. And so we worked with Senator Devlin, because the appropriation hadn't been made. And so then, a year and a half, 2 years later, it was made. And so we want to make sure that they can continue putting RFPs out and choosing, actually making sure that they can approve the dental projects that come in that intend to create innovative practices. So that's this piece. In Senate Bill 698, we want to make sure that there the reimbursement happens.
692, that's okay. Okay, it's 92, don't worry about that. We'll come back to that in a second. Have you had a chance to talk to the director of OHA, the new director of OHA, about funding this with existing funds?
I have spoken to the dental director for OHA, not particularly about the fiscal estimation for this, but about the bill itself, and they seem favorable.
Questions?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I can't find it here. I've been looking, but a few days ago we heard another bill about pilot projects, one in rural and one in the urban area. And is this part of a package? Or?
Can I speak to that a little bit? And maybe Senator Montes-Anderson may know more. I was invited to some of those meetings when they discussed the pilot projects, and particularly the teledentistry. There are individual pilots occurring, and there are separate funding sources, but some of those are from nonprofits that wish to improve dental care. This is specifically looking for pilots within OHA that will administer the pilots, looking at workforce expansion. It's a very small fiscal, just looking at administration, and I might suggest that it would really negate itself in the improved oral health outcomes in the future if we had more innovative workforce for dental care. It's not significantly asking for a great deal of sums for that benefit.
Yeah. Thank you.
Question?
It's more of a comment, Mr. Chair. There are three different dental programs. I know that Representative Boone asked about an urban and a rural. I think that she might be thinking of the foster care pilot project we heard yesterday, but you might be also thinking of Representative Hayden's, which is just a rural project that really focuses more on how do you make the link with schools and Oregon Department of Education to get kids brushing and flossing on a regular basis.
Dental sealants.
So I think these three dental projects dovetail really well together. I'm a co-chief sponsor on all of them. I want to thank Senator Montes-Anderson, who, before I was in the legislature, worked really hard to do this pilot project. There was a lot of collaboration with Oregon Dental Association, who had concerns about if we start expanding workforce, what is that going to mean for the model we have now? And so she did a lot of excellent bringing stakeholders to the table to get that original bill, and it has been working out really well. And the reason there's a sunset on it is I think the Oregon Dental Association wants to make sure that we don't go too far afield in experimenting how do we expand the workforce. So this, the pilot 606, is the overall ability to continue to do these research projects that allow us to go outside of what our normal workforce looks like and experiment, and also have the finances available within OHA Dental Director Office, which is very sparsely researched. He is not even a full-time person because there's so little funding in that particular department, and I think that the funding is really essential in order to seek grants to do these kind of pilot projects, coordinate them, collect the data so that we can learn from them.
And approve them.
And approve them.
The applications that come in from the DCOs are very interested in this also,
right,
besides nonprofits.
Representative Hayden's project, which I joined on with him, is to really make sure that one of those pilot projects that we do for experimentation is linking to the schools. So I think that's very important and complementary to this. And then thirdly, the next one here, 692, is to make sure that medical recipients, OHP recipients, that the providers can get reimbursed for those services. So if we want to actually do pilot projects that are sustainable in the long run, how we pay for those services is an important piece. So I see it as a trio. They're all very important in moving forward.
And Representative Boone, House Bill 2021, the pilot you referenced under Representative Hayden, is it's specifically looking at barriers within the education system and identifying those barriers, which is unique from the pilot study and the teledentistry current going on. And also the fiscal on that pilot was incredibly high. And if you look at the DMAP fee schedule for varnish application, I would imagine that number can come down quite a bit.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing. Oops, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make one of my occasional comments about funding and bills. We hear bills in this committee almost without a doubt. Every one of them is a good idea, or the bill wouldn't have gotten this far. It wouldn't have made it to our subcommittee, wouldn't have made it to Ways and Means, and we wouldn't be having a public hearing on it. It's almost all good ideas. We are in a very limited budget environment. Not every good idea that we acknowledge is a good idea is going to end up being funded at 100% of the request or even at any of the requests. When we have three or four bills all doing something similar, one of the choices is should we do them all and really tackle this problem in a comprehensive way, or to be fair to all the other demands in all the other areas. You'll hear only two or three today. There are probably 50 different topic areas that we have requests in. Do we try to do some in each area to satisfy needs of different population groups? So this is always this is always one of those very difficult times. Yes, I agree. As a package, they're all very important. And every bill we've been hearing for the last couple of months is very important. And I don't know how we're going to accomplish 100% of every request. Actually, we're not going to. But we're going to see what we can do our best. I do have a question, however. We've heard an awful lot of general oversight type of descriptions of what the bill is. Give me a couple of real-world examples. Just exactly what kind of data are you collecting? What is it you're trying to prove about either workforce or health outcomes? Give me a few real data points. What are you collecting, and what are we going to learn from it?
Well, I'll first say I'm a citizen advocate for improved oral health, and I've been working on this issue for years, so I have that data and I can send it to you. But in short, if you look at workforce shortages in the dental profession, we know, for example, that children that are eligible for Medicaid simply have to wait 6 months in our state to even get a dental appointment, and that's not to anyone's fault, except that there's a shortage of professionals that accept those clients. So the idea is to have a bit more workforce diversity and innovation, and if I can bring up another bill that is not related to this, but House Bill 2024 was looking at traditional healthcare workers being able to do basic preventative dental services, and that's been received very favorably. That's looking at innovative ways to have a first dental risk assessment from providers directly in the community to improve then a referral upstream to dental providers. That's just one example of being innovative to help the citizens of Oregon. This bill, I will say, is simply an extension of a sunset, but those studies are already undergoing, and they've spent years getting them going. So I understand that funding is short, but if you cut the funding now, those pilots that are just now actively accepting applications will not occur. So essentially 4 years of work is null and void through the collaboration that they have had. I understand resources are short, but oral health care, as we know statistically, causes emergency room visits, causes, you know, people living in pain and missing school. So I would say the nominal fee for this might be worth the cost in the future of improved oral health.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Capital Dental is a DCO that is applied, and they wanted to look at the uses of dental hygienists in expanding their role in doing assessment. And so those are specific. I mean, you could have Capital Dental come and talk to you, but I don't have a list of all of the applications, but they are in. And this amount, this funding is mainly to accept and approve the application process.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Winters?
Just a quick comment. It's taken us some time to actually recognize the importance of good dental hygiene and its relationship to the actual health of the entire body. And I need to put that on record because often we think only of a dental of going get your teeth, keep your teeth flossed and clean. But there is a lot more going on. And so I, you know, thoroughly appreciate, one, the workforce issue, because you're correct that you are having an aging out population. And two, the connection, whoever has that proposal, with the kids so that they're learning early of what this is. And three, making those connections with the physical health side. I think for too long, just as we did in mental health, we have neglected to link the dots together, that the body doesn't separate itself. So, you know, for me, I think the more we can advance in dealing with the total body, the dental side probably has more to do with health than most people recognize. So I just need to put that on the record as we talk about some of these health issues and wanting to move some at some time in the future where we're actually talking about cost reduction because we have improved the health of the individuals. And so that's kind of those investments, I think, that we started. We did start doing more investments, recognizing that we had a reduction in the ER. Because often the abscesses and what have you that are in the ER that are costly, and if we can get on the preventive side, we have done a much better job. So just have to say that for the
record.
Thank
you, Senator Winters. So I'm going to close this public hearing. The last word will be from Kim Toe, who wants to make a comment about both these bills. We're going to have a very short short public hearing in a minute on 692 because we're running out of time. We've got a lot of people waiting. Okay. Kim, you wanted to make a comment.
All right. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I just wanted to clarify some things to point out the maybe a little confusion about the fiscal. But both these bills, 692 and 606, deal with the same pilot program. So 606 extends the pilot program by 5 years, and 692 just removes the sunset completely. But what 606 does in addition is just also require that the providers of the dental services in these dental projects approved by OHA is also eligible to reimbursement. So what happens is that each of these fiscals kind of overlap. So the quarter of a million price tag, 250 price tag you see for each one of them would only exists for one of them. So it wouldn't be altogether 500,000. If you pass both bills, it would just be
When I read it, I assumed that there was the case. Otherwise, the exact to the penny number, it seems quite a coincidence.
Yeah.
So I'm going to stop it there. I believe my co-chair and I will have a little conversation about how to line these bills up so they make a little more sense to the legislative bodies and may encompass both of them potentially in an amendment that might make more sense to everybody. I don't want to jump out too far ahead here. Representative Kenny Geyer, quickly.
Okay. Just for the record, it's an extension of 7 years.
Right, it's not five.
Okay. So we're closing a public hearing at 606 and opening a public hearing at 692. Jim Roberts?
Senator Bates.
And, of course, the Senator Lori Montes-Anderson will speak
thank
first.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lori Montes-Anderson, a representative of Senate District 25. And I basically, all that 60692 does is make sure that the dental services in the pilot projects are eligible for reimbursement if the services are provided to a recipient medical assistance. We want to make sure that we have sustainable pilot projects. I mean, that's part of the reason of having the pilot projects, and they should have been combined together, but when we noticed that the one extension was already submitted, Representative Kenny Geyer had a bill. We sort of just decided to have another bill that would do that, but they could be combined into one.
Thank you. Mr. Roberts?
Good morning. Thank you for having me, members of the committee. My name is Jim Roberts. I'm a policy analyst for the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board. Our organization is established under the Indian Self-Determination Education Assistance Act, and we represent all nine tribes, federally recognized tribes on health care issues here in the state of Oregon. So on behalf of our tribes, I'm here today to express our support for SB 606 and SB 692. For those of you that may not be familiar with the Indian health system, the prevalence of tooth decay in American Indian Alaska Native children is almost three times higher than the national average. More than two-thirds of American Indian children between the ages of 2 and 5 have untreated dental cavities. Too many children live in pain, have trouble concentrating in school, or miss school altogether. And in extreme cases, risk life-threatening infections because there are not enough dentists where they live or because they cannot afford to receive dental care. So with respect to the two bills, the authorization for the pilot projects are intended to increase access and improve quality to oral health care by teaching new skills to existing providers, developing new categories of dental providers, and accelerating expanding the training to current providers. Our tribal programs are very excited about the potential to increase access to care, to lower the unit costs associated with providing this care so that our programs can become more efficient and provide more services, more volumes of services with the limited funding that they receive from the Indian Health Service. So we encourage the committee to pass the bills. I understand that you've got some technicalities that you need to work out between combining the bills. We think that the clarification and authorization for Medicaid reimbursements is important in recognition that these new provider types or these dental pilots will probably be providing services primarily to the Medicaid population. It's important that they become self-sustaining and be able to receive reimbursements through the Medicaid program. We also support the extension of the sunset provision, whatever form you decide to do. I think it's been a long time to get to this point, at least to get to the RFP that's out now. And there are a number of really good ideas that are out there being discussed about these pilot projects. And lastly, we encourage the committee not to amend the language in the bills or require any type of regulation that might delay implementation of the pilot projects. So with that, I'll stop there, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thanks.
We'll close a public hearing on 692 and open public hearing on 698 relating to school nursing. And we have Jen Baker, I'm going to ruin this name, Nina Ficaris, Tricia Smith, and Kim Bartholomew. And, of course, leading off the pack, Senator Ramon Anderson.
Thank you, Chair,
the
members
member
of the committee.
Of our
committee,
I
know you're tired of me. She used to be on this committee, didn't I take her place?
Yeah.
I just happened to have one of my bills one time. Senate Bill 698 creates the school nurse consultant and a task force, and I feel that this is an extremely important bill because we need to look at reimbursement, and our schools now are funding school nurses.
And there we have a health care system, and now with the Affordable Care Act, we have to look at different ways of making sure that our school nurses maybe can be funded in a different venue. So the ESDs, if you look at the members of the task force, it will bring together a group of people to look at funding mechanisms and look at how we deliver health care services. We need to look at the standards of nursing practices. As you all have heard, we have medication delivery by secretaries. I mean, there's a number of things that our schools are doing, and we need to get a better handle on that, and this is the first step to solving that problem. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, my name is Jennifer Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm here to support Senate Bill 698. As you just heard, Senate Bill 698 does two things, and those are aimed at meeting a goal that the legislature set in 2009 to have one school nurse for every 750 students in Oregon. Currently, we have about one school nurse for every 4,000 plus students. So we have a long way to go and no viable plan to reach that goal just yet. So 698 would create a task force to establish or to explore alternative ways to fund education in the state. Currently, as you just heard, it's funded through the Department of Education, and this important work is forced to compete with other important educational priorities like teachers in the classroom. So we'd ask the task force to look at perhaps billing private insurance for services that are billable if provided in any other setting, to explore working closer with CCOs to fill the gap in some of this in some communities, and to find a stable and permanent funding source for the screenings that schools are currently required to do. And finally, the bill would also create one school nurse consultant within the Oregon Health Authority to help guide this work. And ultimately, we hope with the goal that the task force would come back with some sort of plan to move school nursing services into the Oregon Health Authority, and that school nurse consultant would then take the lead for the state. So with that, I will turn it over to Nina.
Thank you, Chairman Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to come testify before you today. My name is Nina Fakaris. I'm a school nurse and have been working in the schools in Oregon for about 27 years. The reason why I'm asking you to support Senate Bill 698 and why I believe it's fiscally responsible is because it does the right thing for Oregon children. Establishing a state school nurse consultant at the Oregon Health Authority is a national model, a very successful national model that most states have adopted. That position will allow and be a conduit for federal funding and grant streaming that can come through the public health division and can funnel into the school system and provide needed health services for children that we're trying to deal with in our schools. It will also provide a data collection mechanism and will hopefully give us some more fiscal oversight for dollars that are coming into the school providing primary prevention and public health. The task force, then, is a way, and I understand that you've had lots of task force language and legislation this term. The reason why we're interested in this task force is because, truly, it is charged with identifying new funding streams for school nursing services. The services that I provide in the school, administering medication, developing health plans, doing health teaching, health counseling, case management, care coordination, our vision screening, our hearing screening. There's now new legislation this term looking at adding dental screening into the schools. Every one of those services that I provide are reimbursable in any other medical or community setting. So the task force is charged with identifying how we can identify those places that will help reimburse school nursing services. It's a small incentive and a small investment to help us find federal and private funding sources for school nursing services. I serve 3,688 students in my school. I have 23 diabetics. I have 107 children that have life-threatening anaphylaxis. I wrote 234 individual health care plans this school year. The reason I did that was because I want to level the playing field, because children with chronic and acute illness deserve to have an education that's barrier-free, and that's what school nurses can do. I urge you to please support Senate Bill 698.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association here in support of Senate Bill 698. Thousands of OSEA members are school secretaries or educational assistants, and today they are acting as school nurses in schools. And when I say that, I am not exaggerating. As you've heard the statistics for how many school nurses we actually have in schools, what you may not understand is that's because school districts today must choose between a school nurse or a school teacher. After decades of continual budget cuts in schools, school nurses, school counselors, and other healthcare professionals have virtually disappeared. Kids with medical needs have not. They have increased. A few decades ago, through our wisdom and enlightenment, we allowed every child access to a free public education that is integrated into our school system. But we did not provide the medical professionals necessary to keep those kids healthy and safe in schools. So who does it? Secretaries do it. Educational assistants suction breathing tubes, feed children through feeding tubes. Secretaries administer medication that could kill someone if it's not administered properly. And they must do this with everything else going on in the classroom or in the school office. They often have kids lined up out the door and down the hall waiting for their medication as they are checking attendance and doing what teachers need, etc. This is a growing crisis in schools. You'd probably have heard more about it if it weren't for federal student privacy laws and healthcare privacy laws. Those laws prevent you from hearing what might be happening in schools today to students because my members, who are frightened to death every day that they are going to make a mistake, may make one. We need Senate Bill 698 so we can move the ball forward on healthcare in schools, because healthcare happens in schools. The question is who provides it.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Kim Bartholomew. Thank you for having me here, Senator Bates, Representative Nathan and Nathanson, and the other members. I am the Oregon Director for the National Association of School Nurses, and I'm a Beaverton School District nurse. I'm here to ask you today for your support of Senate Bill 698. This is something that's absolutely essential. I'm not going to reiterate what's been said, some of which is also in my testimony, so I'll keep it short and sweet. I have had some contact with the National Association of School Nurse Consultants, and I found that Oregon is one of the very few states that does not have a state school nurse consultant. We pride ourselves in being such a forward-thinking state, yet we have no representative at the state level to act as our collective voice, act as the collective voice for our students and for the nurses themselves. When I contacted them, I had several of the state representatives reach out to me and tell me that they would be happy to give us assistance, happy to hear what we have to say, and they really wished us well in the legislative process with this. The state school nurse consultant will bring to the table a variety of things that the Oregon Health Authority currently does not have, such as they see firsthand how the state school nurse consultant can provide technical leadership, clinical consultation, liaison, and a professional expertise that is currently lacking on the state level. Advocacy for school nurses, students, and family. The consultant will also monitor, interpret, and disseminate information. Currently, we have no standardization in the practice of school nursing across the state, state, and this person would give us that standardization that is so sorely needed. And evidence-based information. Right now, district by district, we're kind of flying blind. You know, we don't have the resources. We end up Googling things, and, you know, that's not always the most effective measure of evidence-based information. But the most exciting thing about this is that we have the 14-member task force, and we have the opportunity to look at other streams of funding. That's the big thing. We don't think that the money that's provided by the ODE for school health should go to school health. It should go to the classroom for other expenses. School health should be paid for by healthcare dollars. So let's do Senate Bill 698 and get that done. And in fact, expand the number of school nurses around the state so all students have access to a school nurse in every school. Thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony. I appreciate your time this morning.
Mr. Chair, yes. Really quick.
Okay.
I just want to reinforce what you just said. I have long believed that as we work to improve the health of all Oregonians, as we work to cut our health care costs, especially with CCOs, that some of the dollars that we're saving should be redirected. And I don't understand why we pay for school counselors with education dollars, why we pay for school nurses with education dollars. Those are health care issues, and they represent an important link. We know that kids, as you've all well stated, the link, kids who aren't healthy don't learn well. They're out of school a lot. The oral health bills that we did before this are equally part of this conversation. And so I firmly believe that we need to rethink how we pay for school nurses and school counselors, and that those should really should be coming out of healthcare dollars, because that's an important intersection between those two arenas. So just getting my two cents on the record on that one.
Representative Parrish, are you here for this bill or next bill? This bill. I wasn't aware. Thank you for your testimony.
And Mr. Chair, while she comes up, I'd like to make my comment now.
Go ahead.
We had some discussions about this. It's been almost a year ago. Well, it has been a year ago now. I served on a task force with Ms. Smith, who just testified, and we identified this as a very pressing and urgent problem. As she said in her testimony, this is pretty close to a quote, "Healthcare happens in school. It's about who provides it." And I would add, and it's also about who pays for it. And I'm very much looking forward to this because for several months, maybe a half a year, we talked about this as being something, whether it should be education service districts or some other regional consortiums to help pull together the information and get this idea going, what's the best way to do this. But it's no longer acceptable to take money from what could be in the classroom and put it into healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we have the same problem with the school-based health center, so it's a common thing.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, state rep from House District 37, Westland and Tualatin. I am here today in support of this whole bill, asking that you'd not, you know, if we have to make a budget choice, not just make it another task force, because frankly, I think we can task force ourselves to death in this building. And but I think we actually need to provide some funding. If you need some ideas for how to fund it, I can show you what we've learned in this state's checkbook and where we can maybe make some adjustments to help get this thing paid for. I live in a school, my children go to school in a school district that has 14 schools and two school nurses. We are one of those consolidated school districts that has two towns, Westland and Wilsonville. So to go from one end of the district to the other in good traffic is a 20-minute drive. So imagine a situation where you have an emergency on one end of the district and whichever nurse is closest has to go 20 minutes in good traffic. Now imagine being a school nurse out in rural Oregon where the drive between schools can be 45 minutes from one end to the other. And if you haven't had a chance to go and take an afternoon to go and spend a day following your school nurse around, I suggest that you do that. Kim Bartholomew is my constituent. She took me out to the Beaverton School Districts. I spent a day with her. We are delivering so much health care in the classroom that to use ed dollars to do that is an absolute travesty. You heard about feeding tubes and kids that are ambulatory. The fact is that we have got to break down the silo between ed funding and health care funding, because a lot of these same kiddos are in our Oregon Health Plan, they're on in our CCOs, and we need to find a way to make sure that the ed dollar side of their dollars that we allocate from the legislature are going to their education and not the delivery of health care. I think the only way to do that is to put this position into the office of the Oregon Health Authority. It has, this bill has a fiscal that I don't think it should have, because it's been padded unnecessarily for adding additional staff or support staff or whatever. And I think you'll hear the people who came and testify say that's not what they're asking for. They're not asking for a support staff. They're asking for a consultant to come in and do this work, find out and understand where the problems are in the delivery, how we can start to use policy in this building to break down those silos between ed funding and healthcare funding. And, you know, just as a comparative, my husband's aunt is a school nurse in Rhode Island in the Providence school system. She's a school nurse only in the building she's been assigned to. Every school has every school in the Providence schools has a nurse. And what she catches is not just the diabetic kiddos and the kiddos who have high-risk medical needs. She also catches the kids who come to school and they don't have the right winter clothes. It's sort of cold in Rhode Island. She catches the kids who have not missed a meal or who've missed a meal and are struggling in class because nobody knew that that child should be signed up for free and reduced lunch. She catches a whole lot of things because she's in the building and she has eyes and ears on all of her kiddos, and she doesn't have to leave the building and get in her car like Kim Bartholomew does and drive to five schools in the course of a school day and eat it, burn up half of your time driving around the district and incurring the expense to reimburse her for the miles if we even do that. So I think this position is critical. I don't think, I think the task force piece is important, but cannot just do a task force again. We know where the areas of need are. It's been a conversation since I've been in the legislature for 5 years that hundreds of millions of dollars of health care being delivered in the classroom. It is time to break down those walls, and I think this position can do that. So, again, if you need some ideas of what to cut in the OHA budget to pay for this, we have that documentation from our checkbook caucus Tuesday night meetings. I'd be happy to make that suggestion, but I hope we do fund this. It's a critical position, and I think in the long run, get us better healthcare outcomes for these kiddos, better preventative outcomes for these kiddos that save us future dollars down the road, and actually do what we're supposed to do for them, is deliver them quality, free and appropriate education. So questions if you need them, but I think hope I was pretty clear.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none.
Thank you.
No. We're going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 698 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 478. Because of our time constraints, we are probably going to carry this public hearing over, but we'll start it today and see how far we can get. Many of us know a lot about this already, so I appreciate if people don't repeat themselves any more than necessary. We'll start with Laurel Stanley, Sherry Maelstrom, and Marjorie Kircher. Are these the four together, you think? I'm trying to put people kind of together. Is Angela Corelli, is she, Angela, are you kind of getting all four of you kind of together, or? Huh? Well, we've got four and three, so it'd be kind of nice if we came up now. Yeah. Nobody
can
do it. Why don't you guys do the wrap-up? Okay.
All right. Good morning, Co-Chairs Bates and Nathanson. I am testifying in favor of Senate Bill 478. As a scientist with several decades of experience studying the fate and effects of toxic chemicals, I am deeply concerned that these are still present in children's products here in Oregon. There's substantial evidence linking them to neurological, reproductive, and respiratory diseases in children who have been exposed to these chemicals. In addition to this bill's goal of protecting the health of Oregon's kids, I ask that you also take into account the importance of economic impacts of toxic chemical exposures as you consider whether this bill is a good investment for the state of Oregon. There are both societal and personal costs related to toxic chemicals. For example, a recent study estimated that these exposures cost Europeans around $200 billion each year in health costs. Comparing our population to theirs, that's like about $80 billion in the U.S. For reproductive toxins, there are high costs of future treatment for infertility. For respiratory toxins, you've heard some nurses here today talk about what they're dealing with in schools. And there are toxins in things like plastics that can increase the likelihood and intensity of asthma in children. For neurotoxins, costs include the loss of future earnings and higher societal costs to take care of impaired individuals. It has been estimated that millions of IQ points are lost in the U.S. because of these toxins that are present in consumer products, including those of children's toys and so forth. There are also indications that neurotoxic damage to children's brains may lead to reduced impulse control and other behavioral aspects related to criminal activity. This came up recently in Baltimore. I think you've heard of Freddie Gray. This isn't in the testimony, but he and his two sisters were highly exposed to the neurotoxin lead when they were children. In summary, Senate Bill 478 is not only critical for protecting the health of Oregon's children, it's also a very wise economic investment for our state. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, members of the committee, thank you for my opportunity to testify in favor of SB 478A. My name is Sherry Malmstrom. I'm a public health nurse specializing in maternal and child health for the last 30 years. I'm here today to testify in behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association in supporting the phasing out of the use of certain chemicals in children's products. ONA is proud to represent over 13,000 nurses. We make up the largest segment of Oregon's healthcare workforce. We work in many different locations, from large hospitals to small clinics, corrections health, school-based health, community public health, etc. The nurses that I work with at Multnomah County provide care to some of the most vulnerable residents. We help take care of pregnant women, new mothers, infants, and children. And while limiting exposure to toxins is important for everyone, it's particularly important to pregnant women, infants, and children. Frequently, the people we care for have nowhere to turn. They're struggling to make ends meet in a difficult economy. They're more likely to be in poor health and have children at risk for developmental outcomes. As you've heard, many of these chemicals in children's products and toys can lead to serious health effects, such as heart disease, cancers, reproductive organs. We know that about almost half of all Americans are living with chronic diseases and conditions, which account for about 70% of the deaths and 75% of the U.S. healthcare costs. So reducing exposure to chemicals contributing to the chronic diseases will benefit the health of American public as well as our healthcare system. As a matter of public health, the state should enact this legislation so that Oregonians don't unknowingly purchase products that contain hazardous materials and chemicals for their child or children and their families, and to ensure that manufacturers are replacing these chemicals with safer alternatives. As a public health nurse, and as a parent and a member of ONA, I support SB 478A. It's an important step to reducing exposure to toxic chemicals and improving the health of all Oregonians. Long term, this bill will ensure parents have one less thing to worry about. Thanks for your time letting me testify today, and I urge you to support SB 478A.
And thank you for your testimony.
I'm Marjorie Kircher. Thank you, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson and the Ways and Means Subcommittee for this opportunity to speak. As an occupational therapist who worked with children with neurodevelopmental disorders for over 25 years, I urge you to support SB 478, the Toxic Free Kids Act. What brings me here today is my urgent concern for children. I have observed a transformation over two decades of working within special education in a large school district, a profound increase in the number and severity of children per capita with disorders such as autism spectrum disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, learning disorders, reduced intellectual ability, and often unspecified issues of language and social cognition, attention and mood dysregulation. Many professionals are needed on intervention teams caring for children with special needs. kids, and the costs add up. Health care, special education, a parent's lost wages, the child's own lifetime of reduced productivity. The financial cost is enormous, but the emotional costs are profound and incalculable. There is little doubt that prevention is a cost-effective alternative. A lot of preventative strategies focus on individual child and maternal health. Avoid smoking and alcohol, take folic acid, avoid contamination in a child's foods. But neurotoxic chemicals in a child's pacifiers, toys, clothes, and bedding could be undermining parents' preventative strategies. We know through biomonitoring studies that neurotoxic chemicals are widely found in people's blood and urine. These are unhealthy conditions, potentially exposing large numbers of children in highly vulnerable windows of development. This can have profound consequences for populations. And that's where public health comes in. The very definition of public health, according to the World Health Organization, is to provide conditions in which people can be healthy, focusing on entire populations, not on individual patients or diseases. That's why I urge you to support SB 478 as a reasonable public health measure to begin addressing exposure to hazardous chemicals at a population level. In order to do our public health duty, we need the cooperation of children's product manufacturers to disclose the use of these hazardous chemicals and to adopt safer alternatives. The science and the economics strongly suggest that an investment in reducing exposures will pay off in a healthier population across Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Angela Crowley Cook with Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council strongly supports Senate Bill 478A. It's a bipartisan piece of legislation to designate a list of high priority chemicals of concern for children's health. It will allow the Oregon Health Authority to collect data on the presence of these chemicals in children's products. And I want to clarify, by children's products, it's any product designed or marketed for children under 12. That's a very narrow definition. And then taking the step of, for certain categories of products, requiring manufacturers to replace them with safer alternatives. It's smart public policy. We've worked really hard to bring a good bill before you. And if there's just one point that I hope you'll take home today from this hearing, it's this. There is sound scientific evidence showing that each chemical on the list of high concern does have one or more of the following properties. Harms the normal development of a fetus or child, causes cancer, genetic damage, or reproductive harm, disrupts the endocrine, the hormonal system, damages the nervous system, immune system, or organs, or causes other systemic toxicity, is persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic, or very persistent and very bioaccumulative. So these are a list of sort of the worst chemicals. There are safer alternatives on the market, and this bill is a good step to help move the market in that direction. So to the specifics of the bill, it's, as I mentioned, it's a bipartisan bill. It's nearly the same as House Bill 3162 that passed the House in 2013, again with bipartisan support, crafted in 2013 by Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Conger. In particular, I want to remind you of the waiver process. In the phase-out portion of the bill, if a company can show that there is no exposure to a chemical in a product, they can apply for a waiver. Or if it's technically or not financially feasible to remove the chemical, they can also apply for a waiver. Lastly, I want to sum up some amendments that we hope will come before the committee. The Dash 16 amendment clarifies the existing food and food packaging exemption in the bill. And then the Dash 18 amendments make the following changes. Changes the definition of contaminant and intentionally added chemical to align more closely with Washington State. Expands the product exemptions in the sporting equipment category, and then lastly requires the health authority to create an exemption regarding manufacturing control programs, which is also similar to Washington. At Oregon Environmental Council, we're not thrilled with these new amendments. They do weaken the bill, but we are happy to see them. We would like to see them adopted so we can move the bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony and your time this morning. We'll call the last panel up now. Tim Shostak, Jennifer Gibbons, and Mike Friese. And the plan is to have the proponents of the bill from the legislature do the wrap-up probably tomorrow. And for those of you who come and want to speak, as far as legislators concerned, I didn't get that message till about 10 minutes ago, so I apologize. We'll get you up for a wrap-up. Is that okay?
I'm also happy to go another day.
I was told that Representative Gomberg said that was all right, too. Is that okay? Please.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathan, thank you. My name is Tim Shestick. I'm with the American Chemistry Council. I appreciate the opportunity to make just some brief comments today relative to SB 478. This issue and this bill in particular has had a long history in this legislature. There's been a number of conversations about the merits of this bill. And I think, unfortunately, there are times you get in a situation where you have two camps, one who suggests that there are four safe products, and then suggestions that there are others who are not for safe products. I think the reality is, in this conversation, that this discussion should be about what makes the best policy sense from a scientific standpoint, an economic standpoint, and a public health standpoint. There's no question in our minds about who and the fact that everyone supports safe products. But yet, this conversation and this discussion is much more complex than suggesting that companies should just remove toxic chemicals and replace them with only safer ingredients. Assessing the safety of chemicals and products is a very complex undertaking. You must examine how chemicals are used, their various hazard traits, any potential routes of exposure, and whether those exposures can be anticipated to cause some sort of harm. You know, give a good example about chemicals. Chlorine is very toxic, but yet it is essential for clean drinking water. So to suggest that you can paint all chemicals in some broad brush, that they're just inherently toxic or non-toxic, does not stand up to a sound scientific evaluation. So when we look at SB 478, we're not opposed based on the objective. Rather, I think it's safe to say that our opposition stems from what we believe makes sense from a scientific, policy, and fiscal perspective. And it is for these reasons that we are working on a bipartisan effort at the federal level to update the Toxic Substance Control Act. That law has not been updated since 1976, and we certainly understand there are questions about the strength of the federal regulatory system, and we understand that consumers have a lack of confidence in that system. But we believe the approach that is moving through both the House and the Senate, as I mentioned, with bipartisan support from Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, Oregon Congressman Kurt Schrader, a number of Democrats and Republicans, is the most appropriate approach to this particular issue. Just real quickly, on highlights of the TSCA bill, all chemicals of commerce will receive a screening review to establish priorities. EPA, when they conduct safety assessments of chemicals, must consider only risks to public health and the environment. EPA is going to be afforded with more authority to demand testing data from chemical manufacturers and others. States have the opportunity to participate in that process in terms of developing a prioritization process at EPA. And EPA must place greater emphasis on protecting vulnerable populations, infants, children, pregnant women, and the elderly. In the interest of time, I will just sum up that we believe that's the approach that makes sense from a policy and fiscal perspective, and from our standpoint, SB 478 is unnecessary. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. I will let the committee know, too. I've had a conversation with Representative Schrader. We'll be speaking more later today. We're running out of time, so please identify yourself to the committee. And
Jennifer Gibbons point. With the Toy Industry Association, Chair Bates and Chair Nathanson, thank you very much for this opportunity to comment. The Toy Industry Association is a nonprofit trade association representing toy manufacturers, retailers, distributors of toys in North America, including member companies in Oregon. TIA supports strong and appropriate children's safety and chemical regulations, but we believe it's in the best interest of children and the consumers that these regulations are maintained at the federal level so that there's one national uniform standard for safety. Products need to be safe no matter where they're made or where they're sold. There are currently 6 different mandatory federal statutes and standards which regulate our product category. ASTM F963, which is also commonly referred to as the U.S. Toy Safety Standard, was made mandatory under the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008. This is a comprehensive standard which evaluates toys for all aspects of their safety, not just chemical hazards, which is what SB 478 focuses on. The U.S. Toy Safety Standard also looks at potential for mechanical and physical hazards, flammability, electrical, thermal, and chemical hazards. So it's evaluating it more comprehensively. This standard has been consistently evaluated and updated, including revisions for 2015. We all do want safe products. I have 2 children under 3. The people who are designing and building toys are also mothers and fathers, aunts and uncles, grandparents. But we have concerns with the unique state-by-state and product regulations. State-based standards that are inconsistent with international, federal, or other state requirements make compliance difficult and costly and threaten the viability of toy manufacturers, distributors, and retailers. In other states that we've seen looking to implement legislation addressing similar issues, there have been significant costs to both business and to government. In California, where similar legislation was passed in 2008, it is estimated that it's going to cost the state $7.3 million over the first 5 years to implement that program. In Maine, estimates show that the fiscal burden associated with the implementation of a similar program would be $900,000 to $1.6 million. And in Maryland, the estimated cost of similar legislation would be more than $500,000 per year in addition to the proposed fees on industry. While SB 478 is similar to these other state legislation, it is also inconsistent, which would mean that the cost to the state of Oregon would be required not only for the enforcement of the program, but also for compliance assistance, as this is a new program that manufacturers would be trying to figure out and retailers would be trying to figure out how to comply with. Additionally, I would like to note that the fiscal analysis done on 478 only estimates the cost associated with the first phase of the bill, which is reporting. And since my time is up, I will just thank you again, but also note that the second phase would be significantly more costly.
Thank you for your testimony. You're last.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bates and Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Fries with Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Retail Council. As a preliminary matter, AOI, as well as the Oregon Retail Council, have opposed Senate Bill 478 and continue to do so under its current form. The Oregon Retail Council is concerned about Senate Bill 478 because even though the bill mainly regulates manufacturers of children's products, retailers fall under that definition as it stands now. If the brand name is affixed to the product or when the manufacturer of a product doesn't have a presence in the United States. Our members consistently make product safety, especially children's products, their very highest priority, and they understand the need for strong and effective safety standards. However, our position is that SB 478 will make no meaningful contribution to the safety of children's products for sale in Oregon. As you have already heard, manufacturers and retailers already perform rigorous safety assessments prior to marketing children's products in the U.S. And in Oregon. Compliance with this law is also inconsistent with other states and potentially with new TSCA reforms, and which will make it, which will increase the burden on Oregon-specific businesses as well as retailers that operate in multiple states. AOI and the Retail Council prefer federal action over state-by-state regulatory patchwork. If the state, however, decides that it is time to do something in advance of federal regulation, then we would ask that it mirror other states that are nearby, like Washington, which I think you will see in the Dash 817s. With that, I'd like to take questions.
Questions?
Representative Stark. Thank you, Chair. Are we going to have an opportunity? You said that this public hearing will be continued, and
we'll be able to ask more questions at that point.
Yes.
I would like to ask more questions at this panel, but we don't appear to have time.
I had questions for the first panel as well.
Me too.
Are both panels capable of coming back at a later time? I think we primarily Billy most of the time. We will schedule that. The wrap-up will be by the legislators who have sponsored the bill. We'll bring both panels back for more questions.
I'm happy to wait and go another time because I'm a part of this. And we're already 10.
That's what he was saying.
Yeah, right. That's
and we're
saying.
Clearly
wrap
out of time
up
today.
Next time around. Next
so
time around.
We will reschedule this public hearing and carry it forward. So I'm temporarily close the public hearing on 478, and we are adjourned today. Thank you.